Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Working in the Coal Mine by Lee Dorsey. Lee Dorsey was born on this day in 1924. And this morning, we're listening to the latest installment of the World of the Play series, where we take an in-depth look at the issues raised by the productions at Everyman Theater. Today, we're looking at the play Death Trap by Ira Levin. I was joined by Linda DiLibero, Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Hollis Robbins, Chair of the Department of Humanities at Peabody Conservatory and Director of the Center for Africana Studies at the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University, and Lewis Shaw, the resident fight choreographer at Everyman Theater.
The first thing I was thinking about was, so we have two theater people and a film person on the panel. So the question is, let's go back. Hollis, where would you take the first thriller in theater? Where do they come from?
Well, the first thriller is actually probably Oedipus, where you've got Oedipus saying, "Who killed my dad?" Oh my God, it was me. You know, that, you know, it doesn't exactly work and unfold that way. But in some ways, the sort of the mystery play does begin in classical theater with Oedipus. But we get the first big move, the country house thriller whodunit with Agatha Christie. But even before that, in the 1930s, the sort of sense of who did it at a time when... Well, I'll get to the sort of the political background of that later. But emerging out of radio plays, emerging out of stage dramas, sound effects, who did it? I guess I don't want to jump the gun and get to the question of why the decline occurred. But the whodunit was really emerged out of questions of detective story, the rise of the detective story that required the resurgence of order at the end of chaos. But the suspense-filled genre was pretty much a pre-war and then immediately post-war phenomenon. Would you?
I would agree.
agree some more, Shaw.
Well, I don't want to start. I was trying to think of the beginning one, the one I was thinking of, and I was blanking on the name, Night Must Fall from 1935, which featured on stage, the best thing about it was a severed hand and the specter of a head, a severed head in a hat box that was sort of sitting on stage that you could sit and you could watch the play and you could actually be physically frightened or disgusted about. Was there or was there not a head in a hat box? And I don't think in most productions it was actually opened at the end. But that very much, that sort of sense of not knowing and not seeing was something that, I guess I am going to toss it to Hitchcock now, that Hitchcock, who differentiated in film between thrill, terror, and suspense, turned into millions of dollars of good film.
And we're still wondering what's in the box.
Exactly.
I mean, and I think that a part of it has to do, and I do want to kind of take this little detour, not detour, but to talk to Lewis Shaw a bit about, in terms of creating a thriller on stage, especially, even in the film, but on stage, has to do with the stuff you do.
That's
it has
great.
To do with making it look the way it looks, to making the blood look real, to making the scene look actual, so people look as if they're physically hurt. You can see them, see it on them, and the weapons you have to create that have to look like real weapons. I mean, that's a huge piece of making this come to life.
When this play was written, a lot of the spectacle we see on stage today is not indicated in the script. And we found in the course of discussions that we had to ramp it up for today's audience. They want more blood. They're not going to accept a death on stage without a certain amount of blood and a certain amount of realism that we're used to seeing in movies now, and as a result, we have to put it on stage. So we spent a lot of time paying attention to little details we could add and sometimes bigger details that would make it more exciting for an audience, and spent a lot of time rehearsing that. For those of you who have seen it, those of you who have not seen it, I'm not going to tell.
I'm going to get to some of that, come back to some of that. So I'm curious what you think, all of you on the panel here. Where is it better? Where is a thriller better? Live, in front of our face, on stage, or on TV, or on that big screen in the theater? Where is it best, and why, or why not?
You're looking at me.
I am looking at you, Linda.
Well, you know, film has so many enormous advantages over the theater when it comes to these kinds of things. And I think it's a matter of the differences between what succeeds on the stage and what succeeds in the film. I think the question is, how does theater overcome the disadvantages it has? For example, in film, the suspense and thrill depends very heavily on our perspective, on our being able to identify with the protagonist. You know, there's always somebody who's a good guy or maybe not so good guy that we identify with, you know, somebody like a Norman Bates in Psycho. And then there's somebody who is, you know, putatively the bad person. And when you have camera angles that can show us the world through the eyes of the killer, you have this unique advantage that theater cannot replicate. And there's also the idea of off-screen space, which can be manipulated at any time. What we don't see off-screen can appear just like that with a cut or with a move of camera. So you have this vast, unlimited number of opportunities to suspend the suspense through time and space. And the theater, you're working with a very limited set of variables. But the thing that I think makes the potential for thrills in the theater in some ways best film is that you have the physicality of this violence erupting out of nowhere. When you see it on film, it may be more real, more vivid. The special effects are limitless. But when you see it in the theater, you know that there are these tangible bodies right there in front of you, and somebody can get hurt. Something very physical can happen. Your reaction is much more visceral, and there's no sense that the director has the advantage of cutting away. You're going to see the full-figured actor or actress actually interacting with someone else, as we did in this play today. And there's something about that that cannot be replicated, I think, on the screen, because you're not really there. And that's the huge advantage that I think the theater has.
We have an immediate visceral response to live theater that we can't replicate in film. We know it's going to happen the same way every time on the film, no matter how many times we watch it. But when the actors are breathing during the big fight scenes or when they're killing somebody, your breath will automatically lock in with them. So if I ask the actor to hold his breath for a moment, the entire audience will hold their breath for a moment until he releases it. And that makes you kind of a single organism, in a sense, in the theater that we can't get in film. And trust me, I love film and work in it as much as they let me. But it's an intangible, well, it's breathing, but there's an intangible connection between living humans in a space that we still desire in a large way.
And there's something about how film and our sophistication as film growers have affected, I think, over time, how we react viscerally. So that the moments, and I'm thinking of that wonderful moment in Jane Campion's The Piano from 1993, when the ministers are putting on Bluebeard's ghost, and the Maoris in New Zealand think that a real murder is going on, and come up and storm the stage because they don't understand the film. They don't understand that this is merely a drama, and it's a really wonderful moment that Campion is using to talk about a number of things having to do with the abuse of women, but also the idea of performance and sophistication of performance. We also saw that a little bit at the end of the film. I don't know how many of you have seen Birdman, the new Michael Keaton movie, when at the very end, if I haven't seen it, I don't want to give something away, but real blood is spilled. And the critic responds to this play by saying, oh, for once, real blood is spilled on the... which I think is unfortunate, as if what you're not doing is not actually spilling real blood, which it both is and isn't.
Oddly enough, real blood doesn't look like blood on stage. for some reason. You can't play it. It's like, oh, there's that fake blood. It's like, no, I got to get fake blood to look like real blood.
And it's why it doesn't look like real blood on screen either, because Hitchcock very famously used Hershey's syrup in the shower scene. That was his blood. Of course, it was in black and white, but they had a lot of trouble figuring out an element that would really look like blood, and it was chocolate syrup. So there are all kinds of subterfuges.
Well, real blood has an opacity that stage blood doesn't. And oftentimes I'm disappointed in film work because you can see through the blood. And we've all bled sometime or another. And it's just not clear. It doesn't sparkle like that. It's got a thickness to it.
So how do you do that?
How do I? Peanut butter.
Peanut butter.
Not in this show. But usually you put a little peanut butter in it. And that gives it that viscosity that, although now there's famously a lawsuit of somebody who was hit with peanut butter-based blood in a show who had a peanut allergy.
Oh, no, that's a
truth.
But I think this goes back to also, I'm concerned when, in what we expect in terms of safety, the sort of safety culture that we live in, when I've been to plays where somebody's going to be smoking on stage, and there's a little note that says, the person smoking is going to be smoking a clove cigarette, right? And we have to understand that they're probably not drinking real booze on the set, that our expectations of a certain safety in a theater, the nice exit sounds, I think inure us to, it makes your job really much harder to provide real thrills when people are worried about whether somebody's going to be actually smoking or drinking on the set. I will compliment Center Stage a couple of years ago did The Whipping Man, Matthew Lopez's mm-hmm. play, and they did an amputation, I think, at the end of right. Act One, and I was totally convinced that they were cutting off that man's leg.
Alan Suddeth did.
Yeah, that was nicely done.
So I wonder again, just staying on the same topic just for a moment, I mean, how what we think thrills the audience more, not who portrays it better, but what thrills the audience more, do we think? Film or the live action of watching this happen on stage? You know, if you didn't, how many of you have seen the play? Everybody's just by good, okay. Well, there's one scene in the play where one of the characters is grabbed and pulled all of a sudden, and you're not expecting it, right? And that kind of leaps out at you, and that kind of, you hear the entire audience go, when that happened, who didn't know the play? So I'm just curious what you think about what is the most effective in kind of making our heart pump, giving us palpitations, the big screen or another human being just feet away from us?
Honestly, for me, it's film. I mean,
why
I'm a film person.
I'm so surprised you say that.
I know. It's shocking. It's really shocking. And again, I keep going back to Hitchcock because I do believe that he changed the game and probably was at least in part responsible for moving the sight of the thriller and the suspense genre into film as opposed to theater, because he was just such an innovator at it. And he had this famous definition of suspense as opposed to shock or surprise. And in suspense, the audience already knows that something bad is going to happen. Whereas shock or surprise means you were literally, thrown for a loop. You don't know that something's happening. You do gasp. His famous example was from his film Sabotage, where a little boy is carrying a bomb and doesn't know it. And he gets onto a bus and he has to deliver the package at a certain time. And we know it's a bomb, but he doesn't, the protagonist and all the characters in the film. So you're literally watching about a 10 or 12 minute sequence where this kid has a bomb with him and he can't get to the place that he needs to get to, which would relieve him of the package and actually blow up people who are guilty. He's on a bus and then he gets distracted by these little parades that are going on in London. And it's excruciating to watch this. It's absolutely excruciating. You don't actually know what is going to happen, but you do know that it's probably not going to be good. And I think that's a much more difficult thing to replicate in the theater, where you don't have that geography of, being able to actually physically embody the twists and turns of the plot through space, where you do have that limited space. And so for me, I think that's one crucial difference between film and theater, this idea of suspension of normal time space continuity, so that you can stretch it out for, you know, ages and make the audience really sweat, as opposed to what you see in many of the thrillers on stage, where you are taken aback, but it's instantaneous, and the thrill is in the fact of the surprise of what I was saying before. Something is happening right there in front of us, and there's a kind of visceral impact there. But the lasting suspense is something that I think film does a little bit better.
I would say the comic analog, though, might work, and I'm just going out on a limb here, might work better on stage, the idea of the farce. And I'm going back to School for Scandal, where you have the lovers or the illicit love interest hiding behind a screen, like, quick, my husband's coming home. Get behind the screen. Get behind the curtain. Get under the bed. And you see, certainly, Shakespeare does this in Twelfth Night with the maids and the others playing the trick on Malvolio, the idea of somebody hiding behind the bushes, these sort of farcical scenes where there's a comic suspense that may well work better on stage than thrill suspense works on stage. And it's interesting, and since the question we were thought to ask was, you know, about the decline of the thriller on stage, I thought about whether also that analog farce is declining, but I'm not sure it is, because again, what the audience knows that the people on stage doesn't know is essentially the drama. You've got three positions there, and the person on stage is all, I mean, the person in the audience who knows more than the person on stage or the kid on the bus is always going to be to have that tension.
Yeah, because it seems, I mean, one of the things I think has happened in theater, we can talk about what this has changed. I mean, majority of plays that you see that are performed today are either comedies, or there are things that allow an actor to really emote, an actor to kind of touch feelings very deeply and carry it through the course of a play. And I think that that's different than in film, just all the way film, the way film is structured, the way it's shot, the way what characters do. So I think that has even intensified since thrillers have left the scene for the most part. I mean, how many thrillers exist in any theater season? Not many.
I think when you go to the theater, one of the imperatives for the playwright is to aim at something larger all the time. You can't have, and the way you would in film, people just kind of can mutter or just look. And on the stage, every single utterance matters. It has to be a little bit larger than life. It has to be presented in a way that is extraordinary, not ordinary. And even when you talk about plays that are, you know, purportedly realistic, like, you know, Death of a Salesman or, you know, some of the great, you know, kitchen sink dramas from British late 50s, if you look at those scenes and you look at the words and the language, there is something extraordinary about everything that people talk about. It's just the nature of the theater. And so these extraordinary emotional kinds of questions and issues are, I think, ideally set on the stage, as opposed to film, which has the onus on it to present ordinary life, just the everyday kind of mundane reality in a way that theater, to its advantage, can't really afford to do. You can't have somebody come on the stage and just sort of mutter about, you know, that you have right. to sound as if you're saying something that really matters a lot. And that's something I think theater does really, really well.
Lewis, you about to say what?
I was just going to say you can have a mutter, but you can't sell tickets to it.
But there's something very dramatic also, I guess, what you can do on the stage, and you probably know this better than I, is just putting a clock on the wall, the ticking clock, the notion of the deadline. Whether it has to be somebody being killed or not is a different issue having to do with a suspense thriller. But the notion of the absolute ticking clock that you know, Thomas De Quincey talked about this with the knocking of the porter on the door in Macbeth to break the mood, that you have something here, you have an external knocking that changes everything in real time. And that's something that, you know, for all the limitations in the fact of no special effects, not to say that your effects are different than other special effects, I do think that there's sort of that temporal, that actual literal immediacy on stage that can't be replicated as well in film.
Well, you think you need fewer special effects to make a thriller work on stage than you do in film?
I think you need different special effects. Yeah, if we're doing a thriller on film and somebody gets shot in the head, we want to see the back of the head explode against the
wall.
Now, I can do that. You know, that's not bad. For those of you who have seen Lieutenant of Inishmore, certainly we shoot the back of somebody's head out and it sprays the entire back wall of the theater. But it in that particular instance, in Lieutenant of Inishmore, it's hilarious. You know, because we know it's got to be. It can't possibly be real that we're sitting there. And in film, you give it up a little differently than you would for theater. Because of that, again, that immediacy between everybody in the room. You can't have anybody hurt in the room.
But when stage gets it right, I mean, I love film too, but when stage gets it right, it really is thrilling. And again, I was thinking about the Skulls of Connemara, which was also at Center Stage a couple of years ago, when they were digging up these bodies and the smashing of the skulls, they got the sound exactly right.
We spent a lot of time doing that.
Well, it was nicely done. I have never heard skulls being crunched, and I hope I actually don't, but I now realize that was exactly what it was. It was really thrilling. It was nicely done.
Yeah, there were a lot of skulls. And the audience.
I was figuring that the skull manufacturer was making a killing on that.
Oh, skulls and skulls and skulls. They cast those all in-house. And there were just racks of skulls because there were four or five different kinds of skulls. And there was a pelvis and there was a femur.
What
and they all got smashed every night. Big brain?
What does that sound like? A little different than, I don't
The femur sounds a little, it's going to be a little more solid. The skulls are very hollow. So the femurs were cast more solidly and the skulls were cast more hollow. And they had to color the plaster so that you didn't see it was white inside once they broke. The audience went crazy picking up
so
skull
good.
Pieces afterwards. Different kind of splash zone than we occasionally have with this show.
It strikes me that one of the problems that my students have is their unwillingness to accept theatricality because of cinema, because they have been taught through film that the highest goal that you achieve in a work of art is naturalism or realism. And this, I think, is a real shame. I think film does theatricality really well, but my students tend not to care for those kinds of films, like musicals, for example, or at least the, you know, 50s MGM spectacles. They always complain, you know, oh, people don't go around dancing in the street and breaking into song. That's just so phony. And something that I think that the theater can redeem is the sense of theatricality is something that is really pleasurable and wonderful. That idea of the extraordinary, whether it's heightened emotion, even in a kitchen sink drama,
right,
or the idea of spectacle, of musicality, of larger than life kinds of visions and ideas, and those kinds of things that the stage had always done so well that I think cinema has kind of taken over and shoved aside. I think that's why people should go to the theater, to see that the theatrical and the spectacle is really something that can give us something that documentary-like reality can't give us. It's art, you know. It's it's very consciously shaped. It's very consciously given to us as an exemplar of something, some higher idea or moral or lesson or, you know, whatever it is. And that's something that theater. Like the thriller, it's a kind of distilled, you know, reality, a kind of intensified reality. And there's something I think we should always take pleasure in and really revere in a very special way.
I think that we're also being desensitized in film to reality by the constant use and advent of CGI in everything. So we know now that that stuff didn't really happen. When they first did Jurassic Park, I think 4 or 6% of the film was CGI'd, and I can only imagine how many percent of the film is going to be CGI'd this time. If I do a... I make a lot of film swords. If I do a sword for film, it's going to stab somebody. I make a full-size one that they CGI in. I make a half one that's cut in half. There's no second half of the blade. And they CGI the second half of the blade in and remove it as it's supposed to go into the actor. I can't obviously do that downstairs. So if you see it here, it's happening. And if we see it on film now, and I, you know, CGI really is killing a lot of the industry in a lot of ways, but making a different set of the industry. And I just feel like it's taken us out of it. It's taken us out of the thriller realm because it can't possibly be happening.
Though I would say that the most wonderfully suspenseful moment, right, in Jurassic Park was the footprint full of water, mm-hmm. right? And that just that moment of seeing the ripples in the water, which was that sort of Hitchcockian moment, just give the glimpse of what's going to happen, I think can be done with as you would say, footsteps, you know, or door knocking, or just sort of the simple implications of danger can be done equally well in both places.
We want to imagine.
Yes, you want to imagine.
We want our minds to go out there. I don't think we want to be told exactly what to think all the time. And that's where film, and I think that it's spurious for us to compare the two, which is better.
Right. I don't think there's a question of this conversation, which is better. But I think they've changed our perceptions of what thrillers are supposed to be. And it has been kind of taken over by the world of video and film and in terms of what we go see. But so you have to at work in some ways a little harder on stage to make that work.
I don't know, because you have to work awfully hard to make it work in film too. I mean,
but the actor's always on when it comes to stage.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, but everything in this show has been highly storyboarded by me. Nobody's looking at those storyboards, but I know exactly where the gags are going to happen, how the magic tricks are going to turn around, where I'm going to replace one thing with another thing so that the audience doesn't see that happen. And they believe that now we're using a whatever instead of the thing that was hanging on the wall, which is not a whatever. So and the same thing happens in film, particularly in thrillers. It's very carefully scripted and orchestrated. Now, of course, here anything can go wrong. And it can in film, too, but it never hits the theater that
right,
way.
Right, right, right. That's on the cutting room floor. Another take.
That's right.
Stop.
That's
right.
Absolutely.
Exactly, exactly.
Or just change the whole script. What
right,
the heck?
Right, right,
we
right.
didn't get a good take on that.
You're listening to this World of the Play installment on Everyman Theater's production of Death Trap by Ira Levin. We're talking about the rise and fall of the thriller genre. On our way to break, we're hearing Because the Night, as performed by 10,000 Maniacs. Mary Ramsey of 10,000 Maniacs, born on this day in 1963. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Johnny Ace performing Pledge of My Love. Johnny Ace died on this day in 1954. This hour, we're listening to the latest installment of our series, World of the Play, where we take an in-depth look at the issues raised by the latest plays at Everyman Theater. Today, we're talking about Ira Levin's Death Trap, which is currently showing at the Everyman. We're discussing the rise and fall of the thriller genre with a great panel of guests. Linda DeLibero is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Hollis Robbins, Chair of the Department of Humanities at the Peabody Conservatory and Director of the Center for Africana Studies at the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Lewis Shaw, resident fight choreographer at the Everyman Theater.
There are a lot of people who, when they're looking at something on stage, they don't get some of the things you've been describing, which is the amount of work that goes into creating what people see on stage. When you described building things yourself, making the skulls, making the femur, making these swords, making the thing that garrots the other person, whatever that is. I mean, that's literally created in a workshop and put on stage to be real.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work there.
I like the log. The log makes me happy.
The log. It was
the
a good log.
In this show.
I like the log.
Like that?
That was a good log.
There's a lot of time in that log. Let that go for now. Yeah, you know, I've been, and it's, you know, when on opening night when I came down and looked at the show, I was like, oh, there's really not that much on stage. Well, I've been working for 6 months on this show, really, to kind of plan it all out and plot it. And but it's really important that you don't see any of it. You can't catch it. If you catch any of it.
Right.
And a lot of that is basic magic and misdirection. I'm going to have you look over here so I can do the thing I need to do on stage left or stage right. You know, oh, a glass broke. Look down there. Oh. While he changes wigs. So
how did that blood come out? People want to know. They're always.
I know. You know, I will promise you that there is nothing about this show that is high tech. It's all low tech gags. Now, which are the best ones? High-tech gags fail all the time. Low-tech gags, you know, they work consistently. Once you get them to go the way you're supposed to go, they work pretty easily. And it's there's a lot of hand manipulation, not to give anything away. There's a lot of hand manipulation. Bruce and I worked on a lot of, you know, basic hand manipulation things. We talk about hand traffic a lot in rehearsal. What's your hand traffic? And it's going to go over here. And that just hides it all. So you can look at the things we want you to look at. Just like in film, you don't know who the best boy is. What does he do? Anybody? I know, but let it go for now.
What does the best boy do? Don't leak.
He's a grip. He's a lighting guy. He's an electrician guy. But that best boy is, if you don't have the best boy, you have no lights, you know? So you got to have that. So we're doing a lot of stuff in the background, and we have people running around like crazy backstage, setting it all up, making it work.
That thing you said, Mark, about the actor having to work hard, and it's true that there is nothing on film equivalent to an actor or an actress being on stage for 2 hours and creating a performance from beginning to end, and you can't stop, and you can't. You know, it's not cut up into little pieces, and it's in continuity. And I think that's something that everybody who loves theater values very highly. And I think that, too, is why the musical on stage continues to thrive. Because if you see a movie musical, even the ones that are made today, and, you know, they're beginning to increase in popularity, you know that the person who's dancing or singing can completely do like 2 seconds of singing and pace, it's been done, you know, that those performances can be edited together little tiny bit by bit. And that's frankly why I prefer to see a 50s musical or a Rodgers and Astaire musical, because I see there are no cuts. These guys are really dancing. Uh-huh. There's a sustained performance there. And that's why we value it, right? Why do I want to see, you know, somebody like, I don't know, Catherine Zeta-Jones in Chicago act as if she knows how to dance? I know she doesn't know how to dance. So when I see a stage musical, we saw at Center Stage, it was a brilliant...
Next to Normal.
Next to Normal.
Which is nicely
great
done.
Production. Great musical. Those actors came out on stage, and within 20 seconds, I had tears in my eyes. And it was partly because it's a very moving play. But it was the idea that these people were doing these performances and doing them so beautifully. It was just tremendously moving. And I knew these people are putting themselves at risk. They could mess up at any moment, but they know that they have to sustain the performance. And that is something that is so thrilling about theater, that, you know, just you can't do that on film. I mean, you can have actors do a speech in one take, and that's somewhat equivalent. But, you know, if they flub it, they just get to start all over again.
All over again. Hollis?
Well, I was just going to say the same thing about the play, because you weep even while you're sitting there saying, wow, I'm getting manipulated into weeping right now. I'm like, oh, my God, there I go. I'm going to be weeping. And I think the manipulation, sort of that the audience assents to a certain kind of dramatic manipulation, because again, the actors are so raw, and because you're sitting there in real time, that it's I've been sort of searching for the words to differentiate the deception that goes on in film and the deception that goes on in stage, and I'm not sure I have the vocabulary to differentiate, except that when it is more raw, I'll just repeat that, on stage, it is more moving and more raw, because it's right there in front of you. And at some point it's in the control of the actors, not in the control of the stage director or the sets anymore to mess up or to give its all. And I think I've only seen one or two times real disasters on stage, loss of lines, breaking down, you know, and right. And when you see it in film, for example, there's that famous scene in Django Unchained, Back to Skulls Again, when the fellow that plays Candy, what's his name? Why am I blanking on his name?
Leo
DiCaprio plays Candy, and he's smashing a skull, and you hear this, it's all over the internet, that he actually cuts his hand badly and has to bind it up in a napkin and do the rest of the scene with a bloody hand smearing blood over the actress's faces. And we hear it after the fact, though, that really happened. It wasn't supposed to happen, and he just went to it for it. And wasn't that amazing to see that on film? Well, that would have happened on stage all the time.
Luke, go ahead.
I'm thinking about notorious mishaps I've watched.
Oh, please tell a couple.
Give us one.
Remember Christopher Plummer losing his sword in Othello back at the mechanic into the front row. And he jumped right down off that stage, followed it in half a second, and kissed the woman's hand. And it landed right in somebody's lap. And he kissed her hand and got right back up on stage and went right back into it. And we found out later that he had asked her out to dinner. And ergo, any lawsuit was alleviated. On the other hand, I watched a sword snap years and years ago at the Folger Theater, and helicopter out into the house and hit somebody in the head.
Ooh.
And that cost a lot of money. Yeah, it was a sword that they shouldn't have been using. Very clearly should not have been engaged in stage combat. That's why they lost the lawsuit, but it just went flying, and everybody in the audience went, bam, down.
Oof, that's tough. So, I going back to the whole notion of thrillers, and whether it's film or theater, whatever culture it's on the planet Earth, we need the thrillers. I mean, humankind needs thrillers, Hollis. We have to have them.
Well, I mean, I think we need a certain kind of resolution and you know, to differentiate, again, between the thriller and the detective genre. And, you know, you just have to turn on the TV to see the popularity of detective or crime dramas or the police procedural, where it always ends in order, or almost always ends in order, not always in the order that we would like, but certain kind of the story being wrapped up, law and order, you know, dun dun, you know, that we understand that there's a certain kind of resolution that we look for, the catharsis and the wrapping up. The thriller, I think, does something different, and I'm not sure we need it in the same way as we would need the sort of resolution, at least 20th or 21st century drama and television and film, because we get our thrills in other places, and you know, whether it's amusement parks or whatever it is that causes the adrenaline rush. I guess I'm thinking more, and we'd had conversations about about the sort of prevalence of method acting, of internal drama, of internal angst being performed on stage and on television. I mean, more people are going to get an Oscar for fighting inner demons than aliens. in a film. And I think that perhaps the sort of psychological thrillers that can be manifested may be more important, if that's sort of what you're asking.
I saw The Babadook the other night.
Oh, how is that?
It was thrilling.
You saw the what?
The Babadook. It's an Australian, not really a horror movie. It sells itself as a horror movie. It's more of a thriller, but it's got some very few special effects. You'd never see a little bit, but you'd never really have that, whatever the monster is, flung up in your face. And maybe there is no monster. Maybe it's psychological story of a parent struggling with depression. And you never really know, and that scared me. You saw the parent kind of losing it, but why? Is it the monster? Are they the monster? But it was the pacing of the movie that really, really was effective. And I think any thriller that's effective in stage or on screen has that kind of that slow burn pacing,
right,
to bring you to where the author or the movie maker or the director wants you to be.
Can I actually ask a question of you, of the music in this? Because I was so fascinated with those low tones and those sort of ways that the music signaled that something was going to happen, but overtly, humorously, certainly not in any underscoring sort of way, mm-hmm. but an overscoring sort of way. Is that in the play, or is that...
No, that's not in the play.
Okay.
No, that's not... And he's very specific. It's not in the squigglies, you know, the little...
Yeah,
it's not in the squigglies. He's very specific about what he wants. And we've had huge discussions about where a key goes in this play, but that's not written.
So you guys added that.
Yeah, our sound designer. Our sound designer is wonderful.
It's nicely done.
Yeah.
Really wonderful. So people have questions here that they like to ask?
This is somewhat simplistic, but I wonder if Lewis could just give us a little bit of the sleight of hand that took place in this play.
Nope.
That then why didn't I come?
just a little.
I can tell you that nothing is coming from where you think it's coming from. If it looks like the blood is coming from somebody's head, it's coming from a whole different source. I have to hide everything in that way. So I'm a little like Penn Jillette in that fashion. So you never know. And there's a lot of people running things back there. And, you know, like I've said, there's a lot of hand manipulation going on. So it looks like he has suddenly produced a so-and-so, but it's the same so-and-so that he produced. And sometimes I have four or five of the same prop on stage so that the one that does the gag is different than the one that he's picked up and held. And, you know, anytime you do magic, you establish what the thing is, and then you make the audience look some other place, and then you change the thing to what you expect the audience to want to believe, and you're going to believe what you want to believe, but you're also going to believe what I ask you to believe if we have skillfully told you that story. So there's a lot. We have doubles and triples of a lot of things that are on stage that kind of, hopefully, you don't see them switch it around. Hopefully.
Got
to keep your secrets.
And really well done, because everybody wants to figure out how these things happen on stage. So maybe you should teach a class. You do teach classes.
I do teach classes.
There you go. Take the class.
We teach stage combat classes right here at Everyman Theater.
Yeah, take the class. Any other thoughts and questions here?
So you've compared film and stage, but nobody's talked about the initial text, in fact. And often, because when you're reading the text, it's all inside your head. Maybe that's actually the best version.
The actual...
Linda.
The play itself or the screenplay. Oh, boy. You know, I'm a bad person to ask this question because there's one thing I don't like to do, and that's read screenplays or plays. I'd rather see the thing itself, which is terrible because... It's literature, you know. A great screenplay or a great play is literature. Maybe that comes from when we were in, you know, grade school and high school, and we'd have to read the play, and that was always my least favorite part. My favorite part was when we got to actually say it out loud, and you could actually hear the effect that it was supposed to have and imagine more clearly what it was supposed to look like. But, I mean... I would say that if you don't have a good script or a good play, forget about it. You know, I look at a lot of movies, some of them student films, some of them professional films, and to me, it all boils down to if the screenplay isn't good, it doesn't matter what the film looks like. It doesn't how much money you threw into it. It doesn't matter how skilled the cinematographer is. It's still not going to be a good film. And it's amazing. I think you can fool some people to a certain extent, but if the thing isn't there on the page, then it just isn't going to really be a masterpiece or anywhere close to it, no matter what you do with it.
You want to go first?
Particularly in the thriller genre, it's important that it's highly crafted. And we're doing this word for word. You see a lot of films where the screenplay is written, and then you're working on it for a week, and then they send you another version of the script, and then they send you another version of the script. And I've worked on a film where we had 26 different versions of the script, and they're all color-coded, and then they have to try and figure out what kind of color to use. But you can't do that in the thriller because it has to be very tightly crafted to get from point A to point B to point C, I think.
And I was just going to talk a little bit about Shakespeare. If you look at Shakespeare's Henry V, where the chorus or the opener is, there's a narrator who's telling you what's on stage. You don't even need stage directions. It's imagine that here's an ocean. Imagine that there are horses. Imagine that this is the thing that you're seeing. And so the page itself evokes what the stage directions are. Are supposed to be, what the set is supposed to look like, what the environment is supposed to look like. And if you read Henry V, Shakespeare's, you know, just the screenplay, as it were, the script, by Kenneth Branagh's film version, you could see both what he's done and the limitations of what film can do because you see everything. And the one I'm just going to critique for a moment, the wonderful speech, the St. Crispin's Day speech, which Shakespeare gives no stage directions to. Branagh, you know, gives it, and then music comes up. You know, French horns come up, which are completely and utterly unnecessary, and the script does not call for music at that point. And you can see, I mean, but, you know, obviously the film does something that, you know, it makes it accessible to more people. You can wind, you can rewind, you can see it over and over again. I'm glad we have it. But at the same time, you know, when you realize that Shakespeare gave us nothing, and yet it still works.
But the great thing about the chorus in Henry V is that by lowering your expectations down, that we're just going to have a couple of schmoes with cardboard swords, he gives you permission to raise your expectations back up. So it can't possibly look as bad as, well, I've seen some productions, but let it go. It can't be as bad as Shakespeare is saying it's going to be. So your imagination takes hold, and you can believe anything at that point.
What about the use of the radio as for thrillers? Because that was a whole era that's what we accepted, just from sound effects. And Orson Welles typified that.
That's a great question. Radio is, I think, a great medium for thrillers.
It's a great medium, Mark.
It's a great medium, period. Of course it's a great medium. What are you talking about? It's the best medium. But
and that really, well, I would say that radio thrillers superseded the theatricals, especially in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And it was partly accessibility. You know, now we have TV, but back then you listened to the radio every night. You couldn't go to a play every night. You could go to a movie, but even then you had to leave your home and pay money to see it. But those great radio plays that became the serial was, you know, partly borrowed from the movies, and it was something that you could do not weekly but daily. Every single day something new would unfold, and that is kind of the definition of thrill. You know, you have that idea of suspense. The story, the radio play would end after, you know, a half hour, and you didn't know what was going to happen. You had to tune in the next day. And that era, I think more people probably enjoyed thrillers during that great era of the radio mystery than anybody has seen in theaters. And even, you know, film itself is certainly nowhere near as popular today as those radio plays were back then.
Very interesting.
And I was going to say that one of the things radio does is foreground those moments of entrances and exits, footsteps, door knocks, that sort of squeaking door opening. And those that moments of people meeting are essential to storytelling. I mean, if you think about all the really fun moments in the Bible, start out with somebody sitting at their tent flap and somebody comes along. You know, all jokes start with a guy walks into a bar. That this sort of right. moment of meeting and that radio foreground those meetings sonically, so you can hear the knock on the door, the window coming open, the door scraping, the footsteps emerging, and your sense of being in the midst of the story is very much heightened by the medium.
But it's a very imaginary medium, so you really have to have your mind at work. It begs the question, is the loss of imagination equated somehow to the loss of the thriller in our society today? I got no answer for that.
That's deep.
Well, you mean when you said, were you thinking radio, film, or theater?
Well, if there's no imagination at work, much as there is even in literature or the radio, the more you're shown about it, right. the less thrilling it is, because you don't have the imagination working to figure the puzzle out. And also, really, you're scaring yourself, right? You're the director or the actors, they're not scaring you. You're scaring yourself. We try to tell you when to be scared or suggest when you may be scared. But when it's all laid out to you, it's not thrilling.
That's what I've been wondering. How pessimistic should we be with generations coming up who have been raised on video games?
Not at all. Every culture has always been worried about the next generation. But it is, I would say that one aspect about the thriller genre and this question of imagination or video games, but is I'm so curious about the way or interested in the idea that so many of these one space dramas, right, these thrillers take place in a country house, right, and not an isolated environment, not suburban, not urban, but this sort of place a little bit surrounded by woods. And there's a way that sense of sort of hominess and isolation, that anything can happen. The police still have to be called, right? That there's that people are in a space that maybe oughtn't be in that space. In the Agatha Christie's, there's, you know, there's a guest, unexpected guests, servants that may not be who they want to be. And that sense of isolation, I think, is crucial. And I think even younger people on video games get that in the kind of haunted house sort of way.
Or the wolf or the witch could suddenly appear. You never know what's out there. But I will say, as a video game player myself, they're often very thrilling. I have had very frightened moments playing video games where I've jumped out of my seat.
Well, I just wonder, when you have, say, an Agatha Christie novel or even a book that gets made into a movie, what's the difference between a story that could be made into a movie and one that will never be made into a movie? And if it is, how is a screenplay different than the thing that you sit and read at home?
Well, notoriously, the things that are most difficult to adapt are interior kinds of, or experimental kinds of literature. Anything that is not taking place in a kind of linear, plotted way.
Hollis?
I was just going to say, some writers famously fail at this. F. Scott Fitzgerald, who went off to Hollywood, just thought and wrote some plays. He has this one famous 1923 play called The Vegetable, which I guarantee nobody has seen because it's just really, really bad. But he, in Hollywood, would write these screenplays that would be, you know, like she was the sort of woman that if she woke up in the morning and put coffee, sugar in her tea, and it turns out to be salt, would have imagined not why it was there, but why she never knew. And it would go on for pages and pages and pages. And that you would, I mean, obviously it's never going to get made into something, because as Linda says, it's not a blueprint for anything except for his imagination in a literary way, what this character would be like. So I think you're either good at it or you then hope that there will be an adapter who will be good at it.
Well, this has been great. I want to thank everybody for coming out. The Rise and Fall of the Thriller, Linda DeLibero. Was this Hollis Robbins, Lewis Shaw, thank the three of you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll talk to conductor Edward Polacek about his favorite Christmastime music. On our way to break, we're hearing River by Joni Mitchell. On this day in 1974, Joni Mitchell went Christmas caroling with James Taylor and Carly Simon.